Shopify's already taken the cash register online, helping millions sell billions around the world. But did you know that Shopify can do the same thing at your retail store? Give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify. That's right, Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. With Shopify POS, you can accept credit cards, mobile payments, and every other major payment method, all with low fees and transparent pricing, starting on day one. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/MLB podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/MLB podcast to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/MLB podcast.
Radio.com Sports presents Big Time Baseball with MLB insider John Heyman and former major leaguer Tony Gwynn Jr.
It is my pleasure to bring in Ron Swoboda to Big Time Baseball. Ron, I think almost everybody will recall you from the 69 World Series and your fine 9-year career. And, you know, it's unfortunate to bring you on at this time, obviously, in the wake of the untimely death of the greatest pitcher I ever saw pitch, Tom Seaver. I grew up in New York. 1969, I was 8 years old. I was at Game 5, and you guys brought incredible memories to all of us New Yorkers to see the Miracle Mets with their amazing championship, probably the most amazing World Series championship in baseball history, and probably the most amazing that we'll ever see. So it's a pleasure to have you on, Ron, and thank you for joining us. For Tony Gwynn Jr. and I on this podcast. So, Ron, as we get started here, the first thing is the initial impressions of Tom Seaver, and my condolences to you because it's obviously a big loss to the Mets family.
Yeah, it really is. You know, he left a lot of wake in his passing. You know, 20-year career with the numbers he put up, and the kind of person he was, and the fact that he went on and created this incredible wine operation out in Calistoga, growing 3.5 acres of Cabernet and making from that a spectacular wine. You know, he did everything with a level of excellence that, you know, mere mortals like me can only look at with envy, you know. But you know, when you saw Tom Seaver, he came up to the big leagues from AAA in 1967, and we weren't much of a team, and we didn't give him a whole lot of help, and he still won a bunch of games and had a pretty good ERA. And you saw in Seaver a guy who just came right out of the chute with the kind of stuff that was going to take him to the Hall of Fame. Once you saw him in a few games, you realized, there was no break-in period. He was Tom Seaver from day one. And day one, by the way, they were experimenting with me in 1967 as a first baseman. So I'm in there playing first base, and Seaver's on the mound, and, you know, he threw that damn thing hard to first base, you know, and I'm like, oh, I'm already too close to the hitter, you know, and it took me a little few games to disabuse them of what was a pretty bad idea. But I had practiced at first base a lot in spring training because they thought they had an idea that Ed Cranepool and I could platoon there. It didn't work.
Ron, how well did Tom fit in? You had been there 2 years prior to him showing up on the scene in 67. How sure. well did he fit in as a young guy in his first season at the big league level?
You know, he was that guy who showed up, and you saw this glow around him, and you realized we weren't a team of you know, we weren't showing a lot of potential superstars. Okay, back then in 67, you know, and Seaver showed up, and you realized, oh my goodness, this is what it looks like when you see somebody gifted, motivated, confident, you know, with power, stuff that he could command. He had it all, and you know, both hands on the steering wheel, and he knew where he was going.
You mentioned you didn't give him much help in 1967, and he still won, as it turns out, 16 games, which is pretty miraculous that he was able to win 16 games, and did win Rookie of the Year, deservedly so. That's a little before my time, but I certainly remember that 69 World Series being at Game 5, and actually it was at Game 4 where you made that incredible catch off of your, I believe that was your idol growing up in Baltimore, Brooks Robinson. Take us back to that catch, which was, I believe, in the ninth inning. It was very late in the game, and I think the score at the time, they had, was it 0-0? I'm not sure, but Game 4, Seaver actually ended up winning that game, and thanks to your catch. What do you recall about that?
Well, you know, I had worked pretty hard. You know, you come up and play in the outfield in Shea Stadium. It's a tough place to play outfield because it stood so tall. And baseball very rarely came out of the crowd, so you were always tracking them against the mercuric background. You could make some really bad-looking mistakes there in front of a lot of people. And you know, of course, it was a major market. But I worked hard on line drives, ground balls. I tried to practice all the tough plays in the outfield and made myself a little bit better outfielder than conventional wisdom you know, would have rated me. And so, you know, here we are, you know, in game four, it's a pivotal game. We're up 2-1, got a 1-0 lead. Seaver would tell you he had less than his best stuff in that game, but he's shutting out the Orioles through 8 innings. In the ninth inning, Frank Robinson, bangs a hard single, Powell follows him with one. He hits it out to me in right field. So we got runners at first and third, less than 2 outs. And Hodges comes out to the mound to talk to Seaver. When I was writing my memoir, Here's the Catch, I asked Tom on the phone what the conversation was about because I was curious. And I hadn't known before. And he said to me on the phone, I have no memory of that. And this was after the dementia was taking hold. And it struck me like a blow in the chest to think that for me, those memories are all gold. And I know it's the same for Tom, except that something had weaseled its way into his brain and stolen the memory and it's gone forever. And that was really disturbing to me. But I later found out that Hodges came out and told him, look, if it's a ground ball back to you, check the runner at third. Don't immediately assume a double play. We want to stop that run from scoring. So that's what they were talking about. And, you know, we're in trouble here. And Brooksy, who had power to right field and right center, he bangs a line drive. And I took what I thought was the best angle I could get to intersect that thing. And I only ran about 3-4 strides. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to think about steepening the angle or playing it safe. I never saw any safe on that except to go for the ball. And I went for it thinking, you know, most of the way you're going to be a day late and a dollar short here. Except I laid out my backhand. And that thing hit me in the web, and I went, oh, my God, you just made one hell of a catch. You know, I mean, the thought comes to mind. I come up, I skid a little ways and come up and throw. Frank Robinson, a great player, tags up, and he scores the tying run. So it becomes a gaudy sacrifice fly, you know, a little extraordinary sacrifice fly. Brooks Robinson, who was struggling to get a base hit, finally hit one pretty good, and he gets robbed by me. a kid who grew up in Baltimore loving him, you know, thinking this was the coming of another, you know, Hall of Fame third baseman when he came up with the Orioles and it came to pass. But yeah, that was for me, you know, I wrote in my book, I quoted Browning something about if your reach, you know, cannot exceed your grasp, then what is a heaven for, you know? And you know, that's what it felt like for me. I mean, that was outside the norm and anything that would be expected from me as an outfielder, but it happened. And if it gets by me, you know, the Orioles might score two runs and we didn't score in the bottom of the ninth. And you know, oddly enough, in his first year, Cy Young Award season for Seaver in 1969, he could have started that World Series 0-2, and we would have been 2-2 with the Orioles going to Game 5 instead of, you know, up 3-1 with a chance to put it away.
That is truly an amazing story. I want to stay with that 69 season, Ron, because as you mentioned, that was Tom Seaver's first year winning the Cy Young Award. What do you remember? Because he set his career high in wins, 25 wins. What do you remember about him during the season and the performances he was giving?
Well, you know, you remember right before the All-Star break, he had that almost perfect game against the Cubs. And of course, by the All-Star break, the Cubs were the team we were chasing. The race sort of laid itself out. It was going to be, you know, we had earlier won 11 straight and kind of vaulted into contention. And the Mets had made at the end of June, which then was the trading deadline. They had traded for Don Clendenin, and that made a big difference. He came in loaded for bear and ready to play and gave us power from the right side. And platooned with Ed Cranefull at first base. I think Clendenin was the missing piece, without whom I don't know if we win it, but he was huge. And so, you know, we're rolling along at the All-Star, going into the All-Star break or thereabouts before the All-Star break. Seaver pitches against the Cubs and he's got no hit stuff. He's blowing them down. I mean, it looks like a classic overmatch with a team that could swing the bat. Who breaks it up in the ninth inning but Jimmy Qualls with a line drive to left center field and spoils the perfect game. But before that happens, Seaver stops on the mound in the ninth inning. And he's just standing there rubbing the ball up, and he scans the stands. We're like 10 deep in standing room only. It's incredible. And the vibe and the electricity in the ballpark, he takes it all in. And I thought that was like, what a presence of mind, you know? It's like, wow. Cause I think he figured this was done. He knew what he had, and so he cranked one up to Jimmy Qualls, and boom, clearing away base hit. And oddly enough, Qualls had just come up from the minor league and did not play much in the big league. But he had had two at-bats against Seaver and had pretty good swings at the ball. You know, he had pretty good hacks at his fastball, and that's what he hit in the left center field. And you know, Seaver said after that game, that's the worst I ever felt on or off the ball diamond. And that says to me an awful lot about the standards. You know, if that's what gave him the feeling, a one hit shutout,
No kidding.
He wanted the perfect game. He wanted that, you know, that complete article there, you know, and it didn't happen, and it didn't happen with the Mets, oddly enough. He had four or five one hitters, but it's incredulous to me that he never, with the kind of stuff he had, with what he took out there every day, never missed the start, and somehow, and I think he reached for it because he came up with a little bit of a stiff shoulder and did not pitch in the All-Star game, you know? Hmm. Pitched in the All-Star game. But he came back after the All-Star game, and what he and Kuzman did those last 6 weeks of the season was ridiculous. You look it up. I mean, if they lost one game between them, it seems like it would have been a lot. I mean, those two guys formed a 1-2 punch that was killer. We were winning 3 out of 4 the last 6 weeks of the season. So it wasn't the Cubs, you know, they hit a dry spell end of August, 1st of September, and we went by them like they were sitting on the side of the road changing a flat tire. You know what I mean?
And, absolutely.
And that, never that. Looked back. We never looked back, you know, and we just kept rolling. But we were in turbo, and they hit a little dry spell, and it was over.
Yeah, that near-perfect game, that Jimmy.
Seaver and Kuzman. It was Seaver and Kuzman, and you know, and everybody else filled in. But I'm telling you, that boom, boom. See you later.
That near perfect game, the Jimmy Qualls game, that's memorable to all of us. I was at summer camp, 8 years old, and I remembered it as a bloop. You said line drive. I think you might be being kind to Qualls. He had 31 hits in his career, and that's funny that you would. Seaver would remember that as the worst time for him. That perfect game that quite wasn't. But you know, I wanted to ask you just generally. The Clendenin acquisition was a key, and you got rolling. You talked about that. But 69. I mean, the whole season is amazing to us. The Mets had never even had a winning season to that point, and were terrible in 68. Right? You were ninth place in 68. When did I mean? You thought you were going to win the World Series, but when did you even think you had a good team in 69? When did you realize it hit you, you know what, we're pretty darn good here?
Well, you know what? Hodges was trying a lot of stuff early on. Now, Hodges said, you know, he said something in spring training. He said this team could win 90 games. In spring training to one of the writers. And, you know, I remember looking around and go, us? Now we won 70, 71, 72 games in 68. And we had Kuzman and Seaver and Nolan Ryan and Gary Gentry and Jim McAndrew and Tug McGraw, some pretty good young arms. We felt like we could get better, but when you haven't been anywhere, you don't know the route, right? You don't know what it feels like, and we're bubbling around 500 at the end of May 1969, and the California teams come in to Shea, and we blitz them, we sweep them, and start what became an 11 game win streak. Well, we'd never won 11 straight in the history of the franchise. Not even close to that, okay? We reel off 11 straight. It starts in Shea and finishes up on the coast against those same California teams, which, you know, is ironic anyway, because the Mets, you know, symbol and colors are an amalgamation of the Giants and Dodgers, the two national teams that left there back in 19, you know, their last season, I think, was 57. And headed for the coast, you know. So we were the National League team. We had the Dodgers script, and the Giants orange was part of our orange, and the blue was Dodger blue, and the NY on the hat was shaped like the New York Giants NY way back when. So we're an amalgamation of those two teams that left New York. And what do? The first time in the history of the franchise, we start this run, and you know, San Diego was an expansion team in 69, and not that good, so we get going, and that's when they made the Don Clendenin deal, when we vaulted into, I said before, contention. That's when they made the Clendenin deal. They said we might need this other piece, and they traded Steve Renko, a pretty good young right-hander who substantiates the deal by himself. But there were three or four other players that went with him to Montreal. But we got the piece, you know, we got the piece we needed, because our offense always, you know, always could use a little help. Cleon Jones was having a great year of vying for a batting title. Tommy Agee had some pop. And, you know, the rest of us fed in there what we could do. Art Shamsky and I eventually became the platoon in right field. We platooned at a bunch of spots in left field. In right field with me at first base, at second base, at third base, you know. So we were a team, you know, we were a team that had turned into something, had come up with an identity, and it was strict platoon, but you had guys who were playing and ready to play and pinch hit and do something if they were needed in a game. And so your extra men were ready, you know, and that made a difference too. And nobody wants to be platoon, but it worked for us that year once things had sort of settled in.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt about it. Ron, we've talked a lot about the exploits on the field in terms of Tom and this Mets organization. What kind of guy was Tom off the field?
Oh, Tom, you know, Tom knew. Tom, we always thought he had a pretty exalted view of himself for very good reasons. You know, he carried himself with a lot of dignity. You know, he did. He knew he had something special. He was a smart guy. He understood. You know, look, great pitchers don't just have great stuff. They're smart. And they remember everything, and they remember how they handled certain guys in certain situations. And I don't know that he wrote any of this down. I don't know that. Rusty Staub, a great hitter, kept a book on everybody. But Seaver's book, you know, he remembered what to do, and he knew where his strength was, and he had a great sense of where he was out there on the mound. And when he went out there, he went out to pitch 9 innings and get the win. You know, nowadays you look at the complete games in his career, and you know, you're talking about an era of baseball that'll never come back. He expected to be out there. If it took him 120, 130 pitches, you know, that's what he intended to do. But off the field, he was the same guy. You know, I mean, he had a dignity and a bearing about him, you know, that, you know, clowns like me looked at and went, boy, I wish, but that's what he did. You know? And you know, he was like Eddie Cranepool said it the other day, like the North Star. You know, you looked at him and said, this is the guy you follow. And you knew, you know, I mean, you knew you weren't going to have to worry about where he was when the sun went down. You know, Tom's not out there clowning around. He's you know, he's taking care of himself. He knows what his purpose is. He's focused in a way that, you know, some of us normal humans probably couldn't achieve. And you saw that. You saw it in every way. And you know, when he did interviews, his interviews were smart and full of observations that you went, wow, I didn't realize that. You know, he was a sharp guy. You know, we went out to his place out in Calistoga. Art Shamsky, when he wrote his book, took me, Buddy Harrelson, who was Tom Seaver's best buddy and roommate, and Jerry Kuzman out to Tom's place in Calistoga that he found this property, and it was full of pine trees and Douglas fir, and he saw the way the land was laying and put a beautiful modern home up on the hillside and filled it up full of really extraordinary art. And I'm a big art fan, and I was wowed when we walked through there and he showed us his stuff. And then you look down the hill at 3.5 acres that was, you know, under cultivation at the time, early in the growing season with Cabernet Sauvignon. It's considered a big Cabernet area. And then, you know, he makes this spectacular wine, you know, from it. If you ever have an opportunity to let a little bit of that GTS pass over your lips and do it. By all means, do it. Do it. And so he loved, he showed us around, and he was so proud of what he had done. And you know, unless you've seen serious wine, you know, grape wine cultivation, you haven't seen agriculture as fine and as detailed as this. Nothing happens by accident. It was really impressive. And you know, and he's got the Cy Young Award balls on the wall and the wins, you know, baseballs from his wins as a player up on the wall. He's got a few of these things. But you were aware then that the dementia was starting to take a toll and had stolen some of his memories. But remember this, man lived his dream as a player and after a player. He lived his dream in a way that most of us can only imagine.
To that complete game point, 231 complete games in his career, just absolutely amazing.
Isn't that something? That is, I remember at an autographing session one time. Seaver and Kuzman, we were in New York, and we had watched a guy pitch for the Mets who had a shutout after five innings and bails out of the game with like 80 pitches or something like that, you know. He went, what the hell, you know. And at the autographing thing the next day, Seaver and Kuzman were talking about when did you start, you know, in terms of pitch counts, when did you start feeling like you were losing it, like you were gassing out? And it was like 130, 140 pitches. You know, they were ready to go. And you know, of course, back then, that wasn't as unusual. You know, there were, you know, Juan Marichal and, you know, pitch some epic long games. And Seaver, as you mentioned, in game four, went 10 innings without what he thought was his best stuff. And he finished that game because, you know, Hodges, you got Tom Seaver out there and you got the bullpen and they were all ready. But if Seaver said, I'm good, you're going to let him go, aren't you?
I think your description of him as a smart and confident, really summarizes Tom Seaver as aptly as you can in only a couple of words. I had the occasion to meet him a couple times as he broadcast for the Yankees and for the Mets and nationally as well. And growing up in New York, I was a little bit intimidated. Nothing he did or said that it was just me. It was intimidating to see a legend like that in the flesh. But you were right about him being a smart guy. In fact, even an intellectual, Dan Shaughnessy, the great columnist from the Boston Globe, has talked about how he had, when Seaver was on the 86 Red Sox, ironically enough, facing the Mets, and he was actually injured at that time and wasn't able to perform in that World Series against the Mets. I'm sure he provided some tips for some of the Red Sox people, as being a smart guy he was. But Shaughnessy talks about how he'd have to get, when he traveled with the team, and how Shaughnessy would have to get up very early in the morning to get the one copy of the New York Times that was at the hotel to beat Seaver to get it, because Seaver was a reader of the New York Times, which not every ball player reads, but that's how he described it.
I was finished as a player. I was between jobs in television. I did about 20 years of local television sports, and I was darn lucky to do it after my career. But I remember visiting with Tom, and he had a bum knee. His knee was gone, and that was going to be his career. And the irony that he's in the other clubhouse and in the other dugout when that 86 team, which I still consider one of my favorite New York Met teams. I mean, they were full of characters and rambunctious as hell. And, you know, they had some guys that could go game a little bit. You know, they weren't going to, you know, you weren't going to dent them too easy. If you could have, they would have been beaten by the Red Sox, who had them down and almost out until that, you know, until game game six, you know, and they could have gone away very easily. But you know, they weren't ready to let it go. That's one of my favorite Met teams. And Mookie Wilson, one of the most amazing guys who to this day swears he would have beat Billy Buckner to first base on that ground.
Well, you might have. I don't know. It's hard to tell on the tape.
You look how Buckner was on his heels, and Mookie could run, and you know, and he was going to have to catch it and then generate some forward motion. And I don't know. I think I like Mookie's case better.
You might be right there, and it's interesting to talk, and people won't remember necessarily that Seaver was part of that 86 Red Sox team, but as us New Yorkers grew up, we felt that he should have been a Met his whole career, and as we know, he threw his no-hitter finally with the Reds, and he won his 300th game with the White Sox, and you know, that sticks in the craw of a lot of us New Yorkers, and you were a sportscaster, I think, by this time, but what do you recall about the actual trade that was part of the Midnight Massacre and all of us New Yorkers did not like with the Reds? What do you think happened there? What spurred that on that they would trade?
Was it 3 or 4 for 1?
Then
Doug Flynn and Wayne Granger.
Pat Zachary and it was Henderson, Norman, and Flynn and Pat Zachary.
Yes, and Doug Flynn used to tell this wonderful story. It really a joke. When the deal was done, Pete Rose came over to Flynn and said to Flynn, "You've just been traded." And Flynn said, "Where?" He said, "The Mets." And he said, "For who?" And he said, "Tom Seaver." And Flynn, who was just a little, you know, just light hitting shortstop, goes, "Straight up?" Well, no.
Funny.
But anyway, Flynn is a great guy. But I mean, that story just, you know, it's like, traded for Tom Seaver, straight up.
What do you think triggered that trade? Was it the money? Was it the personality? What could have done that? Because that was a huge mistake.
You know, I think everybody wants to blame Dick Young, who had, you know, Dick Young used to be kind of a player's writer. And then as he got older, it seemed like his sources were ownership. And somehow they wanted to lay the blame on Dick Young, a writer for the Daily News, wrote a column, sports column, that he had sort of poisoned the atmosphere there for Seaver, and maybe the team needed to make a transition at that point, dump the salary and move on to something else. What they managed to do was get pretty mediocre for a long, long time. Maybe mediocre is a kind word. But that trade was, I think, everything about Seaver was maybe a little too much personality for him and too smart for him, and I think that more than anything, they wanted to move him out of the way. So you know, especially Donald Grant, who wanted to have more control of the team, and of course, Seaver had a lot of gas left in the tank at that point in time, and what they got didn't make them a great team. That's for sure. Didn't improve the team. That's for sure.
Absolutely not. Certainly didn't. But you certainly improved our podcast, Big Time Baseball. Ron Svoboda, it's really been a pleasure having you on. You sell yourself short. You're very self-deprecating. You were certainly one of the heroes of that '69 World Series. Probably the most memorable, at least in my mind, in Major League history. And we really appreciate you having on. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you so much, Ron.
Yeah, John, Tony, nice to be with you. You guys be well and be safe, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Indeed.